From WXXI News, this is Connections, and I'm Daniel Kushner, filling in for Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour comes from the announcement made on March 4th by the Rochester Music Hall of Fame, heralding its class of 2024 inductees. The ceremony takes place on Sunday, May 5th at 7 p.m. at Eastman Theater. It's a balanced and eclectic group of eminent Hall of Famers, including a Broadway singer, a salsa music icon, and a pair of Christian rock musicians. We'll get more into those details in a little bit. But another of the inductees is Rick Beato, who joins me in studio today. He is the rare inductee who is not necessarily being honored for the music he's written and produced, although he's very accomplished in that regard as well. He has become what I would say what I would describe as the preeminent internet musicologist, if you will, for pop music from the 60s and onward. And so I'm really happy to be joined by him today. Rick is a native of Fairport, and he is trained as a classical double bassist, as well as a jazz musician, but he's also a rock guitarist and been a professional music producer as well in his career. And his YouTube channel, Everything Music, has amassed more than 4 million subscribers and more than 842 million views on it. He covers everything from today's top Spotify hits, the chromatic composition of Nirvana's In Bloom, and, quote, the most complex pop song of all time. He also interviews legends such as jazz pianist Brad Meldow, Maynard James Keenan of Tool, Sting, and producer Daniel Lanois. I'm thrilled to be joined by Rick Beato in the studio. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Dan. Appreciate it.
Yeah. How does it feel to be on the other end of the interview dynamic here?
It's strange. I don't like it.
I recall in your conversation with Stuart Copeland, he was really taken with how you describe the process of interviewing people and that it's not an interview, it's a conversation. And I'd like to kind of piggyback on that sentiment. Yes, I'm ostensibly interviewing you for this hour. And we're talking in the context of the Rochester Music Hall of Fame induction ceremony, which you will be honored at this Sunday. And but it really is a conversation. There are so many questions to get to. So I figure we should just sort of jump into it.
If I can interrupt here, Dan.
Please do.
That the quote about conversation actually came, I had dinner with Joni Mitchell one night. And she, not to name drop, but I had dinner with Joni.
It's going to come Mitchell. Up. You're gonna drop some names.
So, and I wanted to interview Joni, and she says, I don't do interviews, I do conversations. I said, okay, conversations. I thought, oh, that's a good one. Because my interviews aren't really interviews. I don't have prepared questions. I just come in and talk to the people.
But I think that's better. Because, like, as someone who prepares questions professionally for a living, I think that when you can go into a conversation and just speak off the cuff, it demonstrates not only your knowledge of the person you're speaking to, but the connection that you have with them. And it enables you to engage with them in a way that maybe you wouldn't otherwise. And it's obvious in the interviews that you do, the conversations that you have, that you, as a fellow musician, you really connect with these people on a very personal and really like natural level. And it comes across in the answers that you get from them, because they really kind of give you the behind the music, like gritty details of the process of making their music, what their thoughts and concerns and hopes were. And it's really, you don't get that in general, let alone on YouTube that often. You have to seek it out, I think, often. So it's really a great service, I think, that you're providing. And as a music journalist, I am really appreciative whenever I see that sort of thing taking place.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. You're very welcome. You've been based in Atlanta for in the Atlanta, Georgia area for a while now. Is there anything specifically you miss about living in Rochester and the Finger Lakes? You obviously have also spent time in Ithaca.
Yep.
Being a student and working there as well.
I miss days like today and yesterday, just absolutely beautiful sunny days that are sometimes few and far between here, but when you have them, they're unbelievable. No place I'd rather be.
Yeah. Ooh, a little Marv Levy-esque shout out you just did there. Yeah. I appreciate that too. I've been talking a lot about how this time of year is my, like, right before the Lilac Festival is kind of always my favorite time of year because all the warm weather is ahead of us, outdoor concerts, all that kind of stuff. As you were coming up as a musician in your formative years here, was there something unique to the Rochester music scene that you haven't experienced elsewhere?
I think that I can speak from growing up in Fairport and when I took lessons over in Pittsford at Northfield Music now, and it was Tom Rizzo Music at the time, or T. Rizzo Music. The Fairport music program was outstanding. One of the best music programs, I think, anywhere in the country. And having 11 full-time music faculty, everyone had private lessons. There were multiple ensembles to play in. They had music theory courses, things like that. You just don't have them in other places.
No.
Back in the 70s, all these wonderful musicians that came out of here, 60s and 70s, people that I've interviewed on my channel, Ron Carter, Steve Gadd, Tony Levin, and it was just a different, as I've lived other places and traveled around the world, I realized how unique of an experience it was to grow up in Rochester and all the advantages that we had and all the fantastic players there are from here.
Yeah. It sounds like what you're talking about is not only the community of musicians and artists, but the infrastructure in which they can operate and sort of develop their skills along with one another. That's very cool. I'm curious, in thinking about the Rochester music scene, I've talked to a bunch of people about this, and nowadays, it kind of feels like it's still a very vibrant scene, but I kind of feel like in terms of infrastructure, the depth and breadth and just sheer number of concert venues that we have access to is the dearth of that, I think, might be holding the scene back a little bit. And I guess I turn it to you and ask, like, what do you see as absolutely, like, necessary for a thriving music scene in your experience here and in Georgia and elsewhere? What makes it all click, do you think?
Engaged listeners, people that actually really care about music and want to go see it live, want to support it in their school systems, want to talk about it with their friends, those kind of things. So they're all part of what makes a music scene thrive.
Yeah. Very cool. It's interesting, right? Like, you mentioned engaged listeners, and I've obviously been, I've been watching a lot of your videos in general, but particularly in preparation for this conversation. And I recall you talking about Gen Z and how you've met and spoken with a lot of them, and they don't seem as interested in music necessarily, but rather video games, and the culture of video games looms large. How do musicians today reach that audience? You're doing that in your way, obviously, with your YouTube channel. I'm wondering what your insight is to that.
Well, my experience with Gen Z is I have kids that are that age, and I know their friends, and, you know, so I see it firsthand. It's not like it's that I'm not exposed to people of that age. My kids are 16, 14, and 11. So, and I see that they have a very different experience with music than we had, my brother John, who's here, that we had growing up. We took lessons, we played music, we played in bands, and we listened to albums and played in the school band, everything. We learned to read music, all these different things. And talking about your favorite music, your favorite artist was a thing that we did all the time. And there was a real emotional connection with music that, you know, in some ways, I think because of the internet has been usurped a bit by video content through kids watching a lot of social media and video content that has music to it, but they don't, maybe are not connecting with it in the same way. And that's not everybody. You can't make a blanket statement about every kid. Everybody has their own experiences. But the difference is we didn't have screens. When I was a kid, we didn't even have cable TV. There were three channels. And as soon as you got home from school, you went outside and did stuff. And when it was snowing and 11 degrees outside here, you stayed inside and you listened to music and practiced your instrument.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I'm in reference to the video that we were just talking about that you made. So I'm a millennial. I'm technically what some refer to as a geriatric millennial, which I think is hilarious. But I was part of, you know, that generation that you allude to in the video, who sort of, you know, grew up with video games, but still had that last vestige of you go outside and play and you experience. And like, so because we didn't have the ubiquitousness of a cell phone or any of this other technology necessarily. So yeah, that is interesting. It sounds like what you're describing is a landscape in which music is not necessarily incidental, but it plays a more supporting role in our consciousness rather than the dominant force that we look to and talk about.
Yeah, and the fact that a lot of music today is served up to people through algorithms, whether it's on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Music, they're suggested based on things you've already listened to. So it keeps people in silos. So there are many artists. I did a video recently where I talked about the song Blinding Lights by The Weeknd. And there's people, it has 4.2 billion streams on Spotify. It's the most streamed song ever. And there's plenty of people that have never heard it. Whereas back 40 years ago, there wouldn't be people that wouldn't know Beatles songs or Rolling Stones songs or Led Zeppelin songs or Whitney Houston songs or, you know, Prince songs or Michael Jackson songs or any popular artist. You knew their music was everywhere, supermarkets, elevators, wherever it was,
yeah.
Clubs. But today you can have these massively big artists and have no one have any idea who these people are, what their music sounds like.
How do you personally counteract the algorithm as a listener?
I don't look at things that are suggested to me. I mean, honestly, I don't. I just search out stuff myself based on what other people, word of mouth, kind of like I've always done, like people used to do.
Right. Do you have, is there an artist or band in your mind that is the most unsung that you've encountered in your experience? I realize it's hard to pick just one. There are countless unsung artists out there.
Well, I probably just say obscure jazz musicians or famous jazz musicians that I think are unsung. Keith Jarrett, for example, who's one of the most famous jazz musicians ever. But to me, he's unsung only because, you know, he doesn't have 10 million Spotify followers, and he should.
Right, right. Does the current landscape and the sort of the metrics that we use to identify a song's popularity, does it feel weird to you? Does it feel like helpful at all or accurate?
That's a really interesting question. You know, people think that, oh, these numbers aren't real on Spotify, or, you know, because that's one of the places you can actually see the numbers, how many times something was streamed. They don't have that on Apple Music. But Spotify, you can literally see how many times any song on a record was streamed. And is that helpful? I think it's informative. And I think that people that say, oh, I don't believe it. Well, the people are paid from the number of streams they have. So they're not going to over, you know, or some people would say in the comments section on the weekend, my video on the weekend song, oh, that's all done by bots. They don't. They can't imagine how big of a number 4.2 billion is. And you don't have people with a bunch of cell phones in a room playing something, you know, millions and millions and millions of times. I mean, it's just not going to add up. These are real people that are playing these songs, and that's why they're huge. But it's fascinating. When SoundScan came out in 1991, that was a way to count digitally count through the what are the codes called that they used to have on the back? Well, that still have on the back of things. ISRC codes.
Oh,
the barcodes.
Yeah.
You never really knew how much records cost. You'd have to take the Billboard's word or however they counted. They would weight things, you know. But then you had this accurate way of tracking how many sales there were based on a computer database that tracked it through SoundScan. So it became much more difficult to manipulate that. So the number one record was literally the record that sold the most copies that week. And that's kind of when we went to these metrics that would determine these things.
Right, because undoubtedly it's got to be more accurate than trying to estimate how many radio airplays a given song gets, right? That's through surveys, or at least I would think.
Yeah. And they've had logs on radio stations, had logs Fair that enough. You'd have to keep because they'd have to pay ASCAP and BMI and CSEC, right? So they would have to pay these licenses. And but now with the streaming, you can literally see how many times. And if you look at a record, take your favorite record, current record, whatever, and go through and start at the top, the first song, you'll notice the singles have the most streams. And then as they get down to the last songs of the record, they will always go in descending amount of streams, no matter who it is. If you have the latest Rolling Stones record or whatever, you look at it on Spotify, you'll find that the three singles or whatever they put out will have millions more. But then there'll be, you know, the track 7 will have 500,000 streams, track 6 will have 400,000, track 8, track 9 will have 300,000. And, you know, and you'll see the declining interest in getting through the entire record.
Right. Which speaks to what you were saying about it not being bots. If it were bots, why wouldn't they want to give a more equal distribution of
Correct.
Streams?
That's right.
That's
just natural behavior.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah, people would listen. Whereas when we bought records, we would tend to put them on and listen through them. You didn't want to damage the record by taking it off, so you'd let it play through. Or sometimes you drop the needle on your favorite songs, but sometimes you're like, that's in the middle of the record. I'll just put it on the beginning and I'll listen to the first couple songs till it gets to that.
That is the thing that I love about vinyl records, is that it changes the way you listen to the music. Because sure, I predominantly listen to music through streaming these days, but what I love about vinyl records is I put it on, and for that 20-minute period when that side is playing, I'm listening to it throughout. And it requires an attentiveness, I think, that you don't necessarily have to have when you just hit play on your streaming player and it just goes through and it'll play that album. And then after that album's done, it'll automatically give you suggestions and a generated playlist that was supposed to sound similar or pique your interest in that way. And so the deliberate nature of the vinyl record is wonderful. And just the having, you know, the physical copy is to me is still really important, and it's a beautiful medium. But anyway, that's a side channel. If you're just tuning in with us here on Connections, I'm Daniel Kushner filling in for Evan Dawson. I'm talking to Rick Beato, who is being inducted into the Rochester Music Hall of Fame this weekend, Sunday at Eastman Theater at 7 p.m. For more information, you can go to rochestermusic.org. for all the details and for the full list of inductees, which I will be sure to mention because I wanna give a shout out to everyone who's being inducted this year. It's a cool group. How would you describe your YouTube channel?
It's kind of a music appreciation channel, I guess. I mean, I started out as a music teaching channel because I had a lot of videos on teaching people about music. You know, it's how to learn things by ear, music theory, composition, song form, things like that. Then I did song breakdowns. I had a series called What Makes a Song Great that I did 115 episodes of. And then I have a lot of countdown lists, top 20 acoustic guitar intros of all time, top 20 guitar solos.
I was just
solos.
Watching that one. I like that one a lot. It's really enjoyable. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah, and then I did interviews. It's probably starting in 2018. I interviewed Peter Frampton, and then I started to do more and more interviews, and artists would reach out to me. And I pretty much only interview people that I'm really interested in, but that's a pretty wide range of music and musicians.
Yeah. What's your favorite of the sort of different kinds of videos that you put out? What's your favorite kind to go back to that just feels the most natural? You can just enjoy it.
Well, if you ask me what my favorite video I've made is, I've made a video where I did a remake of the solo section of Stairway to Heaven, and I had three friends play different solos. I imitated what I thought Peter Frampton would have played instead of Jimmy Page. And then my friend Phil X played an Eddie Van Halen solo, what Eddie Van Halen would have played over Stairway to Heaven. And then Eric Johnson, the amazing guitarist, he played his own solo over it. So, and we happened to have put out the video the day before Eddie Van Halen died, just randomly. But that was a video that I thought was a really fun video. And if you watched one video on my channel, that one would be a good one to go to.
Got it. So you're a multi-instrumentalist. What's your favorite instrument to play?
The guitar. I mean, I like playing everything though, but I like playing the guitar.
Speaking of the guitar, I've seen you know, in your videos, you sometimes demonstrate parts. And in certain videos, you'll talk about how to explore melodic possibilities or even harmonic possibilities. I'm going to nerd out a little bit here. By using the triads or like arpeggios as sort of like kind of a cheat code, if you will. But, you know, you rip off all these runs that are just really dynamic. And what I love about it is on a certain level, from a theory standpoint, it's really kind of basic in terms of the harmonic underpinnings of a song. But in terms of like, as a melodic tool, it sounds, you know, it's virtuosic in its execution. And I was wondering just how you came to that. Was there a particular teacher here in Rochester who kind of gave you that insight, or is that something you just developed on your own as a musician?
Yeah, I think that's something that I developed on my own, just playing things that I like the sound of. And then I figured out kind of what the underlying theory of it was. I said, oh, these things sound cool together when I combine these things. I mean, if I'm talking about things like triads, I mean, I'll do things. I'll mix different types of triads that are not standard, not just major, minor, and diminished and augmented, but I'll use suspended triads and
yes,
and Lydian triads, things like that, that are out of the ordinary.
I'm glad you mentioned suspensions and Lydian, because I went to Facebook and asked people in my orbit if they had questions for you. And one of them was specifically about, so Steve, I'm just going to give you what Steve wrote. Mm-hmm. Steve says, this morning I was watching Rick's video about the sus sharp 4 chord when it was interrupted by a deodorant commercial that started with, I kid you not, the exact chord Rick was just demonstrating in almost the same rhythm. Discuss implications for the future of music.
Well, I say he should probably get get YouTube without commercials, so that you don't have to be interrupted by that.
Right. Yes, very cool. Another listener asks, Ty asks, what about the creation process thrills you the most and why?
Well, I think that I like to just brainstorm ideas for, you know, usually for a few days, and then make a list of things that I find interesting. I only make videos on things I find interesting. So I only ask questions to people of things I find interesting. So when I prepare for an interview, I don't really prepare for the interview. I just start going, and then the improvising part, a lot of times people will say things that are surprising, and then we'll go off in that direction. I interviewed Warren Haynes, a guitar player who played with the Allman Brothers and Government Mule, and he saw a picture in my studio of John Coltrane, and he said, and it was from the Blue Train record, which came out in 1958. And he's like, I have the exact same poster at home. And we started talking about John Coltrane and Miles Davis. And then I remembered that Derek Trucks, when I interviewed him, he talked about the Allman Brothers were huge fans of Miles Davis, and they would listen to Miles Davis all the time. So then that sparked a whole thing in the interview that was nothing, you know, wasn't something that naturally would have happened had he not just seen that.
Right.
And when he said that, I said, oh. And so I thought that was a really interesting avenue to go down, and something that, had I prepared for it and it not just come up organically through essentially just talking, that we wouldn't have talked about that. And I found that whole part really interesting.
Yes, that is very cool. The kind of sort of serendipity or magic that can occur in a conversation about anything, but music specifically. My thoughts turn to this. There's this book called Talks with Great Composers by Arthur Abell, who was an American who was spending time abroad in Germany specifically. And the book came about because he had a conversation with Johannes Brahms. It's this ridiculous conversation, which they talk about everything from the music itself and the nature of creativity to Daniel Hohm, who was an American like spiritualist who could like perform allegedly like levitations and stuff. Bizarre, totally bizarre. And I wouldn't believe it. I still have a hard time believing that the conversation actually existed or happened. But yeah, apparently Brahms told him, you just have to wait until after I die, 50 years after I die or something like that, to publish this. Anyway, I only bring that up to say, like, that kind of improvisational response to something that's happening in the moment or conversationally is really cool. Turning to the Rochester Music Hall of Fame for a second, do you personally have any recommendations for the board for people to consider in the future?
Oh, my brother's band, Northside Johnny.
Excellent. I'm so glad I asked that.
My brother John's here. So he and I started playing guitar pretty much on the same day. He's 4 years younger than me, even though he looks a lot older than I do. That's actually not true. My brother John looks way younger than I do. And
just different hair colors.
And we grew up playing together. And so we have a lot of the same experiences, background, like a lot of the same music.
I don't mean to put you on the spot, Johnny, but do you care to add to anything that Rick has said here at the moment?
No, his thoughts are my thoughts right now.
Okay. Fair enough. I am curious, since you are here, what was that like? You know, I had a brother growing up who was 2 years younger than me, and I'm really grateful for that experience, just as a life experience, to have somebody to sort of grow up with. What was that like as musicians growing up together and feeding off one another, maybe being, were you guys ultra competitive or? Johnny is shaking his head no.
No, not really. No. I mean, being 4 years older, we were never in school together, or we never played in bands together or anything like that, but we would play together.
Yeah.
we get in a lot of fights. If I would, I'd play rhythm for John for 5 minutes while he soloed over Hey Joe. And then when it came to my chance to solo, then he would put his guitar down. And then we get in a fight. So eventually my mom, okay. Our mom would play guitar for me. She's like, all right, I'll play rhythm. What are the chords?
Very cool. So was your entire family musical?
I would say. Yeah.
Very cool. It's, I've got a young family and it, our oldest is playing trumpet and it just feels like what you're describing just feels like such a different environment in which to grow up and try to play music. The time at which these students have to get up just to go to rehearsal, I have thoughts about that. I will say that I just think we need to be incentivizing kids to engage with music, and anything that discourages them from doing that, perhaps the time at which they have to wake up in the morning ahead of school, I don't know. That's a different conversation. I don't mean to turn it into a rant about my personal thoughts. Are you optimistic or pessimistic about the future of music?
Oh, I'm optimistic. Whether it involves humans or not, that's the question. There's some new AI programs that are shockingly good.
So one that I'm familiar with was it Suno?
Suno's one, yeah.
There's a Rochester musician who released an album on Bandcamp that was produced through AI, and it has this sort of faux vintage graininess that's kind of interesting. The lyrics are nonsensical and bizarre, and I personally, and I say this just to get your thoughts, at the moment, I don't see how AI in any artistic medium competes with the human experience God, I hope I don't live to see that I've been proven wrong, because and I'm not here to decry AI, but I just don't. It's interesting, but beyond that,
it's already happening. I play people AI songs. There's a thing called Udio.ai that's a new website or whatever it is that came out. It's a new AI music creation tool. Mm-hmm. And there's things on there that I play for people that are musicians. They cannot tell that it's completely generative. The only person that I could tell is my son Dylan, I have a son Dylan, then two daughters, Lennon and Layla. And Dylan, I played 20 different songs randomly, some that were AI and some were that were real artists, and songs he didn't know, and he picked out the AI ones every single time.
What was the giveaway to his ears?
I said, is it something that I can't hear, something high-pitched? He said, no, there's a sound to it that he immediately recognized. AI. No, that's real. And it was unbelievable. Just could instantly do it. And I asked some of his friends. I had three of his friends over it, and they couldn't do it.
Well, and you mentioned Dylan. He was in your very first video on the channel, right? Or one of the first videos.
That was actually on Facebook. The big viral video that we had was on Facebook about 6 months before it started my channel.
He demonstrated his perfect pitch, right? Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Is that video and the response you got in part what sort of inspired you to do all these subsequent videos and produce all this additional content?
Well, in a way, the video was so big on Facebook, just, 80 million views or something like that, that people would write to me thousands and thousands and thousands of emails, people from other music conservatories, regular people asking me, how did Dylan learn these things? And so I thought, after about 6 months of trying to answer questions whenever I could, I thought, okay, I'll make a YouTube channel where I'll talk about some of the theory involved in that I taught him.
Yeah.
and also taught, you know, about the ear training. Now, his obviously his perfect pitch is something that I believe he was, I don't know if he's born with, but I believe that kids develop perfect pitch in the first 9 months of life or so.
What do you think the factors are that enable somebody to be able to develop that?
I think that it, there's a, I saw an interesting video on YouTube a long time ago by a linguist named Patricia Cool, and it was called The Linguistic Genius of Babies. And she talked about how all babies are born with the ability to hear the phonemes or the sounds that make up words. Of all languages spoken on earth, there's 2,200 phonemes, there's 6,500 languages. And starting at 9 months, babies lose this ability and can only recognize the sounds from the languages that they've heard. And they become culturally bound listeners because they only know the languages that are spoken in their household. And I think that music is a language in that way. So they retain the pitches. If the pitches, 30% people that speak tonal languages like Mandarin have a 30% higher incidence of perfect pitch because the pitch is, this is my theory, because the pitch is so important to the meaning of a word.
Right. The language is a tonal language.
Correct.
Makes sense.
Yes. So why would it account for that? I mean, I'm just using, to me, common sense here, but
yeah,
I played a lot of really sophisticated, what I call high information music for Dylan before he was born. And then in the first year of his life, every day holding him, interacting with him. And then he has perfect pitch. So when no one else in our family has perfect pitch.
Yeah. That's really interesting. I believe we have a caller, so I'd like to turn that direction.
Okay.
Caller, go ahead. Can you give us your name and your question for Rick?
Yeah, hi Dan. It's Sean Brogan from Rochester.
Hey Sean, what's your question?
Hey, so Rick, I just want to say I'm a big fan of your videos. I watch them a lot.
Thank you.
So I'm a Rochester musician. I've played in original bands for years. Dan's familiar with some of the bands I've played in, the solo tunes I've put out. I wanted to talk to you about music discovery, getting discovered as an artist. So I'm constantly hearing, you know, the main way to get discovered now is through TikTok. And the TikTok algorithm demands that you post, you know, a minimum of 3 times a day in order for the algorithm to favor you and start showing your content to other users. And for someone that, you know,
yeah, I don't think that's true.
Full-time job. Yeah. Yeah. So for someone that works a full-time job, but music is still their passion, that doesn't have the time to be, or really the interest to be a content creator, to constantly feed the algorithm with content that you're not exactly passionate about or don't have the time to do, is there another way to get discovered as an artist that does not consist of being someone that has to push out content on a daily basis consistently?
That's a great question. But the whole notion of posting 3 times a day on TikTok is really not true. You'll see people that make videos about how to grow your TikTok. I have about 300,000 followers on TikTok. I don't post on it that often, but you don't have to post 3 times a day, and don't post things when you have something good to post. But how do you get your music out there? Well, I mean, there's a lot of different ways, but you know, YouTube has been a great avenue for people like Jacob Collier, for example, who really got big because of YouTube. There's pop artists. Tate McRae is a huge pop singer now that got famous because of YouTube. There are people that got famous because of, you know, become known because of TikTok, but because of having viral songs on there. And it is a great promotional tool, or had been a great promotional tool until they removed UMG, their music from it about 3 months ago or so. So there's no UMG artists on their Universal Music Group. So that's 32% of the market. But kids don't seem to care about that. And they just will post things from Sony and Warner music artists. But
sure.
So I wouldn't say that that's necessarily the best way to get known at this point.
Okay.
Thanks, Sean, for your
I hope
your...
that was helpful.
Yeah, sure.
Write great songs.
That's always been the focus.
There you go.
Sean is a really active musician in the community currently. He's in several different bands, Animal Sounds, his solo project Beiji. I have no problem plugging this stuff quickly.
Sure.
And yeah, no problem. And other bands as well. He's really, really busy. It's a question that a personal question, but it has a practical application. I saw that you had you were looking at the I can't remember exactly when it was, but it was a Spotify rock music playlist top 10 songs, and one of them was a Greta Van Fleet song, and you'd mentioned that you hadn't covered them on the channel at that point yet, and I think that they're a really good example of they're very divisive. Obviously, their music is clearly indebted to Led Zeppelin. I think that some of the frustration that people have is that they're kind of coy at best about admitting to the extent to which they owe their sound to that band. And I think that sort of gaslighting is probably in part what infuriates people. And I have a classical analog to that that bothers me. I don't think necessarily that the artist is guilty of gaslighting anyone, but I think that fans of his music are not necessarily aware of the musicians who influenced him. And that person is John Williams, the film composer. Mm-hmm. My qualms with him over the years, which I've actually discussed on air on WXXI before with our classical host Brenda Tremblay several years ago, is not with the music itself, nor with his talent. I think those are each of those are indisputable, really. I think what I have a problem with is the fact that his ubiquity, if you will, is such that artists will hear his music and it's original, and yet, you know, I mean, Dvorak is obviously in that famous Jaws theme. It's clearly from Dvorak. And it bothers me that people don't know that, that they don't know that, like, hey, Dvorak did this or whomever. It's a nerdy thing. It's petty, perhaps, on my part. I'm wondering if you could disabuse me of my ire.
Okay, so John Williams is the most known composer that's ever lived on the planet. His music is known by more people than Bach, than Beethoven, than Mozart. His themes are known by more people. You can't reduce John Williams, in my opinion, you can't reduce the things that he may have had influence. Because a lot of influences are because the temp music that Steven Spielberg would put in the movies would actually be the composers. He'd take a whole piece, he'd take things like that. And John Williams he'd want things that were of that style to accompany the things. Temp music is music you put in before the music, you have the score.
He's trying to just follow the filmmaker's suggestion, essentially.
Correct.
For the
yes.
mood.
Yes. Okay. And John Williams is one of the most gifted, probably the most gifted composer. No, unquestionably the most gifted composer that's lived in the last two centuries, I'd say. It's from the 1900s on. And I don't have any problem saying that. And you cannot take a few themes from a couple movies when John Williams has done hundreds of film scores. A film score, a two-hour film score, is an 800-page score.
Yeah.
Okay? So the amounts of... Go into Indiana Jones, that thing, and go to listen to some of the incidental music in there that weren't the main themes, and they're absolutely brilliant. And so... It's to me, it's way too far of a simplification.
It's
to say
reductive.
That, yes, it's reductive.
I was trying to think of the most blatant example I could think of. I hear you, and I think I agree. I'm a curmudgeon about this for sure. But I brought it up because I do think it seems to me that, like, perhaps if I could extrapolate what you're saying here, is that maybe we shouldn't get hung up on how original an artist is or isn't, and maybe just enjoy quality music when and where we can.
Yes, and I would not put John Williams. I would put him way above quality music. It's some of the most brilliant. His melodies are known by every culture in the world. And he talks about, if you listen to some of the interviews, about the permutations of, let's say, the Indiana Jones theme, or the Star Wars theme, or the Darth Vader, the Imperial Death March, or the Imperial March. These themes are so incredibly memorable. And it's extremely difficult to write things that are memorable to billions of people.
Especially nowadays.
Especially nowadays. Yeah. Yes.
No, I love it. I love it. You're convincing me with every passing second.
Yeah, he's the most known composer that's ever lived on the planet, period.
That is wild, but undoubtedly true. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely
true.
Unquestionably true. There's more people on the planet than there ever have been, and more of those people, three-quarters of the population of the people on Earth know some John Williams themes.
Want to shift gears slightly. Is there any artist or style of music you currently dig who your fans might be surprised to learn about?
I talk about pop music that I like all the time, and my people that watch my channel get mad at me when I talk about it.
Who can you give an example or two of an artist that is making really good stuff right now?
Well, it's more that I appreciate the really well-produced music. That and when I compliment things that are really well done, it makes people mad that follow my channel. Now, my channel is not people of my age, the demographic of the people. You know, YouTube has very detailed analytics, and yeah. 25 to 34 is the most viewed demographic on my channel. So people that are, you know, a few decades younger than me. I'm 62. But when I compliment things, and I always try to look for the positive for the most part in music, even when I'm listening to the, any contemporary music, I try to find the positive in it most of the time. Unless,
is there anything you can't get into? You just like any genre that just sort of like you can appreciate it maybe or respect it, but just like in terms of your taste, just not for you?
I mean, I think it just comes down to this, to the song or the,
Fair enough.
I like things that have melody, that have, that are contemplative, that have dissonance, that have memorable things and, impactful moments that are not just beige, if you will.
Yeah.
That are, you know, not. I like things that change keys, that are just more interesting musically.
Sure. Yeah. I can appreciate that. I mean, I alluded to it earlier, but, you know, it's just fun to just sort of watch you listening to that Sergio Mendez song. And just like being like totally surprised in such a positive way by it. And
that's from the Rochester Parks when I played in 1983. I did a summer gig around the they were youth centers in around the city, and one of my friends got me into this, and there was a saxophonist, Terrence Bruce, that was in the band Cabo Frio. He was the leader of it. And we had a female vocalist and then a drummer that was a singer. And that's that song, Never Gonna Let You Go, they wanted us to learn. And me and my friend Paul, that were jazz musicians, figure, oh, we can learn this song in 2 seconds. No problem. What is it? Let's hear it. And then they play the intro, and then all of a sudden it changes keys in the verse. And then the second half of the verse changes to a different key, goes up a half step. Then the pre-chorus is in a completely different key. And then the chorus changes keys. Well, there's 22 key changes in the song. So they're playing the cassette, and we couldn't believe it. We're trying to learn it without a chart. And then we laughed because we kept screwing it up so badly.
Yeah. That's wild. So we're going to be wrapping it up shortly. But yeah, I just want to. We could talk for so much longer, but I'm really grateful for the time we've had. Thank you so much, Rick, for talking with me today and joining us here in Rochester on Connections.
You're very welcome. Thanks, Dan.
Sure. Just wanted to remind everyone briefly once again, Rochester Music Hall of Fame, class of 2024, being inducted at 7 p.m. on Sunday, May 5th at Eastman Theater. For more details, you can go to rochestermusic.org. I think we have another minute and a half or so. So I'll put in another question to you.
Mm-hmm.
And this is from Brian, who wants to know, what kind of elements of, quote, the Rochester sound do you pick up on most when you hear it?
I'm not sure what the Rochester sound is.
I'm not sure either.
I don't know what that is.
Yeah,
John, my brother, is there a Rochester sound?
I don't know if I could quantify a Rochester sound in any way.
I know great Rochester playing when I hear it, and there's a lot of amazing players from here. So,
yeah, is there some? In I imagine there isn't anything in particular. Like, it's just quality is quality, right?
To a certain extent. I think.
Yeah. So this year's class includes Johnny Vega, John Ellison, Jennifer Cody, Charlie Lowell, and Matthew Odmark, and Scott Mayo, as well as Rick Beato, who joined me today. Thank you again to John and Rick. It's been a pleasure to talk to both of you, and have a great weekend, everyone.